The Guardian.
Football Weekly Extra.
Today, a bad week for big name outfits. Villa at Bradford, that messy jacket. And Chelsea playing Welsh side at Stamford Bridge, with Branislav providing the leaks. Pod salutes the midweek winners, the Swans and Bantams, and then starts the countdown to the weekend's action. Man United, Liverpool, RVP Suarez scoring showdown, QPR Spurs, Harry versus the team that showed him the door, and Man City against Arsenal. Yaya, Aguero and Nasri all out. Will they pay dearly? Their supporters certainly will. All of that plus Fifth Bro nonsense in today's Football Weekly Extra. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Football Weekly Extra. And here today, Owen Gibson.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Sean Ingle.
Hello, Jimbo.
Greg Bukowski.
Hi, James.
Yeah. Owen, you've just been with the governor of Tokyo.
I have been with the Japanese equivalent of Boris Johnson for an hour and a half.
And why?
Very interesting chap. He's written a lot of books.
He's
talked about Roland Barthes. Tokyo are launching a bid to host the 2020 Olympic Games.
Right. And you come into this how?
Because I write about the London Olympic Games.
King
want to persuade me that it's a really good idea.
Yeah.
I can make the difference. I think that's the...
Okay. Goals scored per game in major European leagues. Sean, where do you think the Premier League ranks?
I reckon it ranks just behind the Bundesliga. I'm guessing it's about 2.9 goals per game.
No, you're wrong. How far down do you think?
What, the Premier League?
Yeah.
In major European leagues?
Yeah. Well, you say major.
Well, that's your definition.
I know
the goals are going up and up. I think we're on course to be the highest Premier League goals in recent memory.
And yet, they're only seventh in Europe. Really? You said 2.9. It's actually 2.87. So
I was rounding up.
Wrong there. But Netherlands is the top with 3.12. That's where you want to watch your football. Eredivisie.
Being a lot of nil-nils in the Premier League this season, which everyone's forgotten about. I looked into this beforehand, and there's been 597 goals conceded in the Premier League this season. Don't ask me why I was looking into it. I just thought I'd have a look into it.
Right.
Last season it was 564.
So hang on, what was it now?
It's 597. So,
slightly
more, more goals. But there's been a load of nil-nils in amongst those those performances that you've seen, like the Chelsea 8-0 and other scorelines this season, 5-3 and stuff. On the same week Stoke have beat. I think Stoke have about 4 nil-nils.
Yeah. But enough for that, though. I'm querying Jimbo's assertion that the Eredivisie is a major league. I mean, I thought you were talking about the big four leagues in Europe.
It's a major league. Okay, it goes like this. Netherlands, Eredivisie, 3.12 goals per game. Then Austria, then Belgium, then Germany with 2.90, who are tied with Denmark. And then you've got Spain, who are a fraction above England, and there you go, cliche confirmation, ahoy. Italy are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11th on the list. France are even further down.
So England are effectively third among the major leagues,
if you like. Why are we talking about this? I'm not sure, it just popped up on Twitter and I was just surprised about it. So because I was under the impression that goals were, everyone complaining about the defending and the goals per game going up in the Premier League, and surely it's best in Europe, etc. But no.
That's right. It seems to be in sort of weird peaks, doesn't it? I mean, some games have skewed it, probably.
Up, though. I mean, the Premier League, if you look historically, certainly since the sort of the mid-noughties, it's been going up most years.
Be interesting to see where the League Cup fits into the, if it were a separate tournament, because, of course, there were plenty of goals in the two semi-final first legs.
It certainly wins the prize for the most comical defending, doesn't it?
Well,
any tournament.
Yeah. Shall we start with Wednesday night's action? Swansea at Stamford Bridge, in a night of Proustian drama, with on one hand Torres still à la recherche de temps perdu, but Michu and Graham winning the Swans way.
You've lost me completely.
I think
I see what you're saying. But I thought the interesting thing about Torres was the fans have very definitely turned on him now as well.
Right.
For a long time, there was almost a perverse pleasure among the Chelsea fans in supporting him despite everything, and last night it didn't look like he was trying. They booed him when he went off, they cheered Demba Ba when he came on, and you just feel that's even tipped for him now.
So Benitez has had the opposite effect on Torres then, by essentially being Spanish and having had now he's linked to him. It's like, well, he's a bad boy.
He's been tainted by Benitez.
Having been brought in effectively to solve the Torres problem, it doesn't look any closer to doing that.
In a sense, he might be solving it, but
by
not
signing Demba Ba.
Danny Baker tweeting this: if I gave you £1 million tax free every single month for the next 4 years, it's not a genuine offer, by the way, that would be exactly how much more that Torres cost than Michu. Interesting stat that. With all of this,
as you say, comical defending. And Rafa Benitez says we'd win 9 out of 10 games playing like that against Swansea. Do you think that's fair?
Well, again, I mean, Benitez, all the talk around Benitez coming in was he was going to tighten up the defence, he was going to get the best out of Torres. And last night, neither of those things were true. And I don't think they would have won 9 times out of 10. I mean, actually, in terms of chances, clear cut chances, they didn't have that many. They had a lot of dominance in the first half, but clear cut chances were, you know, relatively few and far between, and just it was just very bad mistakes.
I mean, I'd stick enough for Benitez slightly. I mean, they did have 23 shots to Swansea 7. Now they had 7 on goal and 4 against, in memory serves.
Yeah, but lots of those shots were amounted to
6 corners to nil, 64% of possession. I think in most games Chelsea would not have lost.
Can't tell you everything.
No, like, but in most games, you know, you would not have had. I'd agree with you on that.
Those mistakes, Ivanovic doesn't necessarily make. He's one of the defenders who's been making fewer mistakes.
Well, that's what I thought. He was one
he's
of the more
pretty good seasons.
He's done all right, and he wouldn't normally do that. And Sean's right in that Chelsea so many chances and so much possession. Swansea on the break scored 2 goals, and they've been very good on the counter attack this season, and they've been much better defensively.
Well, Michael Cox posting Ivanovic is terrible on the ball. Ferguson's tactics at Stamford Bridge exploited that well a few years back. Let him have the ball, keep it tight elsewhere.
Well, he doesn't make normally, you know, mistakes that cost games and cost goals. I mean, I'm not saying he's a, you know, he's a very skillful defender and he's comfortable on the ball like someone like Daniel Agger or Rio Ferdinand, but he generally plays to his limitations, and he's very strong, you know, and doesn't make these kind of mistakes. He's mentally strong as well.
It seems to me that Benitez has already fallen into the trap of playing to Abramovich rather than sort of answering questions. Honestly, I mean, that all seemed designed to kind of make excuses for the performance. And he also seems to have, unfortunately for him, fallen into sort of Avram Grant, Scolari trap of winning the games that don't matter and losing the ones that do.
Right. Well, of course, this isn't over, this semi-final. There's still the second leg to come in a fortnight. But in the meantime, Swansea, how about them, eh? A draw against Arsenal the other day. They're doing fantastic in pretty much every competition they're in.
It's become a complete cliche, but Michu is obviously the signing of the season by any yardstick. I mean, you know,
Peter Hoos.
Speaking of which, Jimbo, sorry, I was looking through Sid Lowe's the Sids for last season just to see, and he had Michu in his Spanish team the season. So it wasn't that much of a shock, and I can't believe that some of the Premier League, you know, clubs that employ scouts, they employ a lot of technical analysts that go through all the stats from various European leagues to draw up, you know, lists of players they might want to sign.
It does make you wonder about these supposed much vaunted scouting networks. I mean, Chelsea put a lot of money into theirs. Arsenal, of course, is long famed, and you do sometimes wonder, you know, why are they missing these players that aren't that hard.
On the plus side, one Premier League side didn't miss them. Swansea did sign them, and a lot of European leagues are going, well, why don't we pick up players
also,
like?
I mean, bringing in De Guzman as well, I think they brought him on loan from Villarreal, is very good business. And I think he's had 4 or 5 assists this season. He's made the loss of Joe Allen. He's limited that loss. He brought him in. Also, he brought Keane, who's physically strong, which Swansea perhaps lacked last season. They were getting turned over away from home. He's 6'3", very strong. He gets around a lot. And he's made Swansea much more difficult to beat on the road than they were last season.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, in some ways, Laudrup's made them a little bit less tippy-tappy. You know, there's definitely a steel there, isn't there?
And Danish steel.
Who knows as well, if Swansea do go on to get to the final and win it, they get into Europe, maybe the narrative will be less about where are these players going on to next. Maybe not Michu, because I'm sure somebody's going to come in for him, but they might not be seen as just a stepping stone. Then they could actually be a team that you want to go to and stay at.
Wow. But again, Michu, you wonder if, you know, kind of, as a lot of these players do well in one season, you know, he's got a team that's largely playing to his strengths. I mean, would it be such a good move for him to go to a top four club?
Right, although he did pretty well at his last club.
He did too.
Equally, Peter Hurst says, in Denmark, people go crazy over Laudrup and Swansea. How is he perceived in the UK? Laudrup?
Oh, he's had a hugely well thought of, isn't he? I mean, he's had a great start.
Right, but is there not a little bit of, oh, it's Mickey Laudrup? Whereas if it had been, say, a manager who hadn't had such an illustrious career as a player, I think people would be absolutely going bonkers about him and saying he's going to be the next United manager, he's going to be the next England manager, etc.
Still early days, though, isn't it? You know.
Yeah. Mm. Hmm. So how is he perceived, Sean?
Well, so far, I mean, I think Owen's right. Like, the people will wait and see if he can do it for a second season. Because, you know,
people didn't wait for Phil Brown to do it for 2 seasons.
Oh, come on. I don't think anyone here was bigging up Phil.
No, but I'm just talking about the general perception. I just think his illustrious career overshadows even the great things he's doing as Swansea manager. There's a bit of an assumption that the club has already set up and he's just
not... There is a little bit of that, the sort of, you know, the narrative was set, you know, Martinez and then Rodgers, and then he's just come in and sort of picked it up. But as we said, I think he's already made some significant changes that have sort of built on what they did.
Right, okay. Well, Swansea this weekend have the chance to pull off another big upset when they travel to Goodison Park. That's a big game, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. it is a big game. And Everton have been playing, you know, they've been playing very well. They had a number of draws, but they've kind of...
Well, Monday night, of course, that big, what was it, 5-1 against Cheltenham?
5-1 against Cheltenham, yeah. In which the referee apparently was calling all the Everton players by their nicknames and
was he?
Calling all the Cheltenham players just by numbers.
Right.
Shows the, you know... horrific class divide that exists between the Football League and Premier League.
What were the nicknames he was using?
I think I can't imagine. You know,
Fellaini, what's his nickname?
Bainesy lads, Bainesy. You know.
Jelly.
And his name was Kevin Friend as well, the referee. So right. There you go. He's living up to it. Yeah, Billy. Yeah.
I was just going to point out. I think it's a tough place going to Everton's clear. I mean, they've won nine of and drawn four of their last 15.
Chelsea won that.
They did,
yeah.
But it's still doesn't excuse the fact that it's still a very difficult place to go.
That's true. And then you know what another difficult place to go is? The toilet when someone's standing next to you. No, Stoke. Sorry, I got confused for a second. Stoke. That's where Chelsea are going this weekend, hey? It's not the kind of game you want, really, is it?
If you're Rafa Benitez, I don't think you do. No,
right.
And kind of all the. I mean, he had a mini spike, didn't he, over Christmas with the sort of the 8-0 at home, and it looked like that he was sort of bedding in there. And then you know, two home defeats has knocked him right back. And I think he's, you know, the level of rancor among the crowd last night was quite striking.
Right.
Well, Stoke haven't lost at home for the last 15. I think they've won 6, drawn 9. So a lot of draws in there.
How many have they conceded, Sean?
I reckon about 7.
He's on the money. Ka-ching.
But Chelsea have quite a good record, though. I think if I'm right in saying they've won 2 and drawn 2 of their 4 trips to...
I'm not going to argue.
Benitez hasn't got a good record, though.
No, that's very true.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, they drew the fixture 0-0 last year. That would be one of those 0-0s you're talking about.
Yeah.
Again, it feels like, I mean, it's Groundhog Day.
But that was with Torres playing. Now they've got Barr, they'll score loads.
It's slightly Groundhog Day with Chelsea, though, as well, because again, you feel like people are saying, oh, they need Terry back. You know, maybe there's this Ferrari around Lampard at the moment. Does he need to be starting? And they still haven't moved on from kind of, you know, who are the big characters who are going to sort of take that team on to the next stage.
You sometimes wonder whether Benitez's role is to kill off old Chelsea, get rid of Torres, get rid of Terry, get rid of Lampard, and then probably do it himself so someone can have a fresh start with some.
He's the sin eater.
Explain.
It's a reference. He's the sin eater.
Sin eater as in so macho.
No, not. Although, yeah, that would be an interesting managerial appointment.
Because, I mean, did she effectively end
the
career?
She actually lived about 100 metres from Stamford Bridge. Might still do, actually.
Really?
She lived really, really close. Back in the days of So Macho and My Toy Boy. Yeah. How did I know? It was just a fact. She lived on the Fulham Road, just up from Stamford Bridge, because I was living very close myself. In an apartment, which actually nowadays would kind of pretty much... It's not there anymore.
How does that relate to Rafa or Chelsea?
Because I was talking about him being the scapegoat, the man brought in to do the dirty work and then get dispatched.
Mm.
And I think...
Take the blame with him.
Take the blame. Wow. Stormy clouds on the horizon at Stamford Bridge, etc. and that. Right, part two, featuring special Bradford Aston Villa love, after this. Now, Tuesday night, Bradford Aston Villa. Bradford, the team 8th in League Two, twice in administration since they dropped out of the Premier League, with a lineup put together for £7,500. Extraordinary, coming up with yet another giant killing act. It's not over, clearly, but 3-1. 3-1. How big an upset was this, Sean?
It was, despite Villa's problems this season, it was still huge. And I think they deserved it as well. I mean, their keeper made some wonderful saves and Villa started very brightly. But after that, I mean, they had the energy, they had sort of the drive. I mean, they didn't play like a team that have... The rate in League Two,
right, which is the fourth tier. Just to emphasise that, despite the stupid name.
Absolutely, I mean, for my sins, I opposed Bradford at half time, thinking that Villa would improve and come back, but no, they didn't, and Bradford completely deserved it.
Do you mean in the markets, or you weren't holding up banners outside the?
No, I didn't. Yeah,
down with this kind of thing. Yeah, stat of the week: Bradford City of League Two have now beaten more Premier League teams this season than QPR. Amazing. Yeah.
What surprised me was how sort of low key the players were at the end. If you like, you know, they weren't obviously having taken several scalps already. Maybe they're getting used to it, but they were very much. It's half time. We've got a job to do. You know,
right.
Let's move on rather than kind of whooping and hollering.
They haven't conceded that goal as well, which means that 2-0 will do it for Villa at Villa Park. But I think on the subject of Villa, I think if they concede a goal,
can I just say before we get on to Villa?
Yeah, go on.
Bradford are now 2 matches from being in the Europa League.
Oh. Well, yeah.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you know, if they hold on to their league and reach the League Cup final, they'll be the first club from the fourth tier to do so in 50 years.
And would that be a good thing for Capital One, do you think? Or do you think they'd be throwing, the marketing director would be throwing himself off a tall building? Swansea brandy.
I mean, it's news, isn't it? I think more people would be interested in that than, say, a Chelsea Villa one. Anyway, Villa, Greg.
Oh, yes, Villa. They're so brittle mentally. If they concede a goal, they don't win games. I don't think they've won any Premier League game in which they conceded first this season. And they can play some very nice football at times when the wind's blowing in the right direction, and they've got some nice young players. They've got Benteke up front, who's been on form, and it's a good job he's been on form, because had he not scored the amount of goals he scored this season, they could be in a lot more trouble in the Premier League. And he had a shocker the other night, you know, in comparison to recent performances, and that showed how poor Villa can be when he doesn't play well and when they concede early. I mean, they've not really got a physical presence in midfield who can kind of, you know, stamp his authority on the game and kind of lift some of the younger players around him.
And you can visibly see them sort of wilted. You know, the fact that he has thrown them all in together. You know, kind of he's there's been some sort of perverse praise for it in a way. You know, kind of isn't it good that he's sort of given youth its head? But it just shows you have to blend it.
I was chatting to David Pleat over the summer, and I was asking him about Villa, and he basically said, "This is the season they need to survive. They need to stay up." Because he said, you know, in the youth team, they've got a number of players who he thinks will make the grade at Premier League level. But this current crop, he said, he wasn't convinced by. But he's, you know, he thinks if they get through this season, they, you know, they could actually have a decent future. But at the moment,
they're 1 point from the drop. At the moment, they've conceded 20 goals in their last 5 matches. Ooh! And this weekend, of course, they're up against Southampton. A huge match that, because Southampton are the team that's indeed right below them.
It's interesting the dynamics of these things, isn't it? Aren't they? Because, you know, Lambert still very much has the backing of the Villa fans. It seems, you know, despite the position they're in.
We have had the captain Ron Vlaar has been injured for those weeks in which they've conceded all those goals as well. And I think Richard Dunn, he's been injured. I know he's perhaps not the best player anymore, and he's probably going to head
sort
off
of
to
experience they need.
They're the kind of players who can lift some of the younger ones around them, and they haven't had them around in the squad.
All right, Darren Bent coming back into the picture in the last 2 cup games, but going out injured again now. Huh. Not the best news for Villa as they prepare to host the Saints. Anything else we want to say about Bradford?
I think they've just done fantastically well. I mean, you know, you could say, you know, the Arsenal games are a one-off, if you like, but, you know, they've done it, they've now repeated it, and, you know, kind of it's clear that, you know, they're a very good team, especially the goalkeeper.
And they're probably getting more kind of press coverage than George Galloway, so that's good news for Bradford.
Right, yeah. Phil Parkinson eager to sort out his contractual situation. I don't know if that's going to have any... It could be dark storm clouds ahead for a Valley Parade. Let's move on now to FIFA, who've only gone and handed out a large golden orb for the Player of the Year, and you'll never guess who it went to. Sid Lowe, next on the line.
Hello, James.
Hi. How are you, Sid?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, Sid. Now, exciting news, blah, 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 blah. Switzerland, large World Player of the Year award going to Leo Messi. Now, Sid, apparently, of all the tweets and analysis you've ever done, your tweet about the cost of Iniesta, Ronaldo and Messi's jackets has caused the most reaction. What did you tweet and what did people say?
It was a breakdown in Sport, the Catalan newspaper, of the cost of the suits of the three men were wearing. And one of them was Dolce & Gabbana, one of them was Armani, and one of them was He by Mango. So I think I'm right. I think this is the right way around. Ronaldo's suit, €3,500. Messi's suit, €1,500. Andres Iniesta's suit, €286.
Cool. Well, Messi's suit was worth every penny, I would suggest. Very, very, very special jacket. Yeah.
Messi actually said afterwards, well, you know, everybody gets used to the same old thing, so I thought I'd try something different.
Right. His jacket certainly was something different. In other news, Sid, and, you know, well done to Leo Messi and all that. Marca's war with Mu is intensified. That's something we'll maybe cover a little bit more in the paper review up on Friday, but I bet the papers were delighted, were they not, with the fact that FIFA's, or the FIFA Pro, because this is voted for by the players themselves, the other players' union, their World 11 features only players from the Liga, and all but one of them are from the Clásico pair.
Yeah, 5 each, plus Falcao from Atletico Madrid. That has pleased people, of course, and I think that's helped to mitigate a little bit that slight sense of frustration that a Spanish player hasn't won the award, despite this being 2008, 2010, 2012, the most successful international team of all time. Because I think there's a recognition that, that however good Spain are, in terms of individual players, Messi and Ronaldo probably stand ahead of most of them. I think in Spain there was a sense that they would have quite liked Iniesta to win it, just as they would have liked Xavi or maybe Casillas to have won it in 2010 or even Iniesta back then as well. But the fact that it's, you know, all Spanish league players on the podium, and significantly within that, I think it's, what, seven of them are from the Spanish national team, or six are from the Spanish national team. So I think that reinforces that. So, of course, is the fact that, that Vicente del Bosque gets the manager's award,
yeah,
which I suppose in a way is a roundabout sort of way of saying which was the best team this year in the world.
But Sid, you'd hardly put, surely those four defenders, you'd argue they're the best four defenders in the world.
Man, Casillas,
and the goalkeeper as well.
Casillas isn't even good enough for Real Madrid.
That you look at, in terms of the team of the year, for me, I mean, you know, obviously you can argue this, and fundamentally, I'm amazed how angry people get about the Ballon d'Or, considering it's a vote. Ultimately, lots and lots of people have voted. A few strange ones have turned up, but so long as people vote honestly and don't vote for... On that subject, yeah. I think there's some really shifty votes in there, and this is something that irritates
Palestine?
Me a little bit. It irritates me a little
bit.
Did
you see who Palestine put down?
Who did Palestine choose?
Mario Balotelli.
Good on him.
No, but yeah, the Ballon d'Or,
but no,
sure.
Honestly, hang on, James. Yeah. On that very point, one of the discourses that you hear a lot, and certainly I hear it a lot here, I don't know if it gets expressed quite as much in England or not, is this kind of thing of, oh, well, what does the guy from, I don't know, for argument's sake, what does the guy from Jamaica or Djibouti know about football, and what's he doing voting, and what football does he watch, and blah, blah, blah. And you go through the votes, and actually the most ridiculous votes are from the biggest countries. The ridiculous votes are not from these, in inverted speech marks, tin pot nations. They're not.
Right.
They're from the big countries. And why? Because they vote either with friendship or I think with fear. Because that's the problem with an open ballot, because their votes get picked through.
But
so the Italian manager votes for an Italian, the Spanish manager votes for a Spaniard, the German manager votes for a German. Obviously, the English manager wasn't going to go quite that far. He didn't do that. But that's the frustrating thing.
I hear
for me.
You. Sid,
I mean, I have no problem with people choosing whoever the hell they want, as long as they choose it honestly.
Sid, it's Greg. Surely it comes down to like Real Madrid and Barcelona probably being on the telly more than any other teams as well. And the fact that other players vote, they probably all watch Real Madrid and Barcelona on a Sunday night as well. Some of the more honest votes, I thought, were the ones maybe from players who had played against other players. I think someone voted for Yaya Toure. And he said, well, that player's obviously played against him in a game last season and thought, Jesus, he was the best player I played against last season.
Hmm.
And that's, say this was 30 years ago, this vote, you'd have had a much wider spread because players wouldn't have played against Real Madrid and Barcelona.
But a wider spread doesn't necessarily mean a more accurate overall result. But I think that's absolutely true. Although, funnily enough, I went through this, I think it was 2 years ago for a piece I wrote, and I went through exactly that concept that you're talking about. That idea, which I really like, I agree with you, I really like that idea of a player playing against someone and thinking, bloody hell, he was good, and voting for him on the basis of that. Being confronted by someone in the flesh and thinking, this guy is just unbelievable. And I went through it and was looking at some of the votes of some of the players and trying to work out where the balance was. And I think it was because back then there was quite a lot of Didier Drogba votes. And I was trying to work out, was this people who played against him either in England or in African World Cup qualifying and so on? And funnily enough, it doesn't always work that way. But yes, of course, there's an element of that. But it's also natural, isn't it, for people to go for people who they're watching on TV, because that's how most of us watch our football and how players watch our football. Your player from Fulham, how many times is he going to come up against someone who's genuinely in line to maybe win this award? How many times is he going to have the opportunity to be blown away by it? Madrid, Barcelona, that's who we think are the best. That's who we watch on telly. And we see him do things on telly that we don't see other people doing. It is pretty striking, though, from my point of view at least, that there's no Bayern Munich or Chelsea players when they're two that made it to the Champions League final.
Yeah, absolutely extraordinary. Absolutely.
And I think Bayern Munich should have had a couple of players. And I thought they were really good in last year's Champions League.
Right, Martin
and
Dunlop.
Maybe Juventus, who finished the season unbeaten.
Right, exactly. And had a bit of a special Euros as well, Chiellini, Buffon, Pirlo. Anyway.
Well, particularly Pirlo. But then, of course, James, one problem with the Pirlo.
Yeah, the midfield, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Martin Dunlop says Jürgen Klopp scandalously overlooked.
And in the final,
no.
He got taken apart.
Well, yeah. But now, on the manager's front, that's another question because it's all Liga there as well. And Del Bosco. Jürgen Klopp scandalously overlooked.
Can we talk about Liga in the manager's front then?
No.
Go on. Go on, let me. The shortlist of 10 the shortlist of 10 managers didn't include Diego Simeone.
Yeah, well, that's crazy, isn't it?
I think that's an absolute scandal. Right. I mean, but again, you know, look, I'm not going to get angry about it. Yeah. I don't understand why people do, because fundamentally people have voted, and if that's what they've chosen, they might have been a bit daft, but that's what they've chosen.
Right.
The one thing that I think is worth getting angry about is is the possibility that the Portuguese vote was a bit of a kind of grubby little manoeuvre.
Oh, right. Well, in the meantime, Ronaldo, I notice, has already laid down his marker early for next year's race with Messi, or this year's race with Messi, with a fantastic hat-trick against Celta Vigo.
Yeah, brilliant. Really, really good. He's really kind of taken on the sort of role of leader now, Ronaldo. He's dragging Madrid three games, even when they're not playing particularly well. He was hyperactive last night, really was absolutely everywhere. And there are times when you watch him, he's just an absolute beast. And the third goal last night, I mean, there's nothing particularly special about it, really. But it's a counter-attack, and Higuain is probably, I'm guessing now, what, 40 yards further up the pitch than Ronaldo. And Ronaldo starts sprinting up left-hand side, you know, flying past people, in the end for a relatively simple pass and simple finish. But it's the run and the determination at the moment. And, you know, lots of people don't like Ronaldo, but I think it's very hard not to admire him.
One other thing we should mention about the Jamboree, there was the Goal of the Year award, which went to who? Owen?
Went to Miroslav Stoch, who was on Chelsea's books and now at Fenerbahce, and it was some goal, but no one who saw him at Chelsea, I think, would ever have imagined him winning World Goal of the Year. It's fair to say.
Was this the volley off?
Yeah, the volley off the corner.
How was it?
It was fantastic. Yeah, it was like this kind of like the Scholes goal from years ago. I think people will remember for United hitting a direct volley off a corner,
right.
But it was from further out and on an angle and nestled in the top corner. It was fantastic.
Super. Well, listen, another round the world miscellany. Inter have accepted, but Wesley himself hasn't yet, a Galatasaray £8.2 million offer for Wesley Snyder. Joey Barton was named Marseille's Player of the Month for December. How about that? And Nicolas Anelka's training with Paris Saint-Germain. Not sure what that means. In Italy, Juventus beat Milan in a rousing encounter at the Juventus Arena. Interesting this, because it was settled by a Mirko Vucinic goal in extra time, exactly the same as last year. 95th minute last season, Juventus put Milan out in extra time with a Mirko Vucinic goal, and there you go. And they ended up losing to Napoli in the final that year. They faced Lazio in the semi-final. This time, the other side of the semi-final will be drawn from Inter and Bologna and Roma and Fiorentina. The last one will be a particularly interesting game with Vincenzo Montella up against Roma again, who gave him a bit of a pasting when they met in the league recently. One story which caught me by surprise, Udinese looks like they might be without their defender Danilo for a while, because he's been sentenced to a year in prison by a court in Brazil for racist abuse. This from an incident in the 2010 Copa do Brasil, where he was playing for Palmeiras, and the court found him guilty of spitting in the face of the Atlético Paranense player Manuel and calling him a monkey. And
sounds like UEFA and FIFA could learn something from the Brazilian court.
Yeah, year in prison.
Well, I mean, we'll see whether there's going to be kind of appeals and stuff like that. But. Right, moving along, and another glamorous outpost of the game, Blackburn Rovers have made an official approach for Michael Appleton, who, of course, only took over at Blackpool in November and has done brilliantly since then, winning two games out of 12, I think it is. What's the story here? Michael Appleton, when did he become the kind of Pep Guardiola of du jour?
It's impossible to pass anything that's going on at Blackburn these days. I mean, it's just the most bonkers club.
He made another judgment off, like, what, someone's over a month or two and how they performed. It is being run. It's a shambles.
They've just won three games in a row. They're doing something right. All right. Mark Cole, who tweets under the moniker Black Bile, nice stuff. Sean's thoughts on Luton's success in the Cup, Sean?
I thought it was thoroughly deserved. They played ever so well. I was chatting to John Ashdown, who was at the game. And
name dropper.
He said the place was rocking. I get invited. I have some friends that go all the time. They're always inviting me, but I have family commitments. It's hard these days. But they're off to Norwich in the fourth round, and they'll probably lose, but I bet they give it a good show.
Just in case anyone's forgotten, who did they beat?
Beat Wolves.
Wolves,
1-0.
Right. And Stolly's settled back and got... Yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly, right, okay. Right, that's it for part two. After this, we're going to be looking forward to a particularly enticing weekend in the Premier League. Sean, you had a mouse running across the front room of your house last night.
Yes.
What did you do about it?
Well, I couldn't see it. I didn't see it.
Hit it with a Kuna bean or something?
My wife saw it, screamed and jumped up onto the chair like a stereotypical 50s housewife.
Right.
And looked at me and said, what should we do? And I kind of had a look around, moved the sofa. I couldn't see it. It was gone.
Don't look for it.
But what
do
you do,
anymore.
Though? If you're kind of like ethically minded, I don't want to kill the
mouse.
Make
a pair of shoes from it or something.
Get a cat. Buy a cat.
Well, apparently there's some sonic waves that you can send in that kind of
thing. Oh, we had those, actually.
Do they work?
They did work, yeah.
You plug them into it.
I once rescued a mouse that had been caught in a trap in a New York flat because I felt really, really sorry for it.
Right. Was its back broken?
No, you know one of those sticky things where stick to it and
do
it was...
Do they work?
Well, this one hadn't properly worked. So it was kind of like... It was going round in circles because it was weighed down on the left with this sticky thing. Oh. And I had to... very carefully pull the sticky thing off its skin without ripping its back open. And eventually I rescued it and it ran off to worry someone else in another flat elsewhere. So,
right.
Great story, eh?
All right, if you live in New York and you're having a rodent problem, Greg Bukowski,
I think I'm right in saying, though, that they're a bit like cats. They sometimes return. So you have to, apparently, if you do save a mouse, you have to... dump it at least a couple of kilometres away from your house, otherwise they can find their way back.
So put it in your pocket, take it to work with you.
Take it on the tube with you.
All right, well, in other news, QPR taking on Spurs this weekend. Now, you don't have to be Harry's dog to know that this one adds up to drama. Harry taking on the team that showed him the door ruthlessly last summer. QPR, of course, coming off a phenomenal junk-killing exercise away to Chelsea last time out. Can they do the same to Spurs?
Well, I think probably not. I mean, I think it was probably, you know, I think they played very well against Chelsea, but it was very much a smash-and-grab operation, and I think Spurs are really strong at the moment. Although, again, it's interesting, isn't it, how sort of managers' fortunes now sort of wax and wane over weeks rather than months. I mean, it doesn't seem very long ago at all that Spurs fans have started grumbling about AVB and, you know, they're down to eighth or something, and now they're, you know, top four and looking set, you know.
Yeah, with the right results, they could be three off City by the time this finishes. They did actually lose this game last time they visited Loftus Road.
Well, that was in QPR's, you know, run when they won, beat Liverpool at home. They beat lots of good clubs at home, and then just about...
Spurs were in their run where, you know, sort of post-England speculation, all the rest of it, so they were losing every other game, weren't they?
Spurs have got so much pace as well going forward, and still QPR relying on the likes of Clint Hill at the back, and, I mean, it turns so slowly, I just think
this extraordinary statement from Fernandes when they were right at the bottom of their slump, saying, oh, everyone was being so full of praise when we signed all these players, and now you've turned on us, and I don't remember anyone really sort of hanging out the bunting for Jose Boswinga when they signed him, or even sort of Sean Wright Phillips. Or
Tal Ben-Haim, who's just come in. Ryan Nelson, how extraordinary is this? I thought there must be two Ryan Nelsons when I read that he just... It's a bit weird. You're a key man at the back for a team in the middle of a relegation struggle, and you sign on as manager for a team in a different league on the other side of the world.
It does. While protesting that you don't really want to go, it just smacks a little bit of...
Thought he said that he did, because his body couldn't withstand the rigors of a Premier League season anymore.
Yeah, but he said he'd be sorry to go, basically.
Oh, right, what's going to happen there? They're not going to let him go, are they?
It sounds like they are, yeah. I mean,
the season starts in March.
Everything
in the
MLS, Harry's saying sounds like they're going to let him go. I mean, it'd be a massive loss for them.
Well, he heads more balls, makes more clearances, more interceptions, etc., than any other QPR player, which admittedly is not saying much. But you know, he's been the player that was only... You need Ryan Nelson in there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It'd be a big miss.
Well, of course, William Gallas might be taking his place. That's the latest there. So QPR not a chance? Can you go?
I think Spurs will win that one.
You do?
Yeah.
Sean?
I would expect Spurs to win. I mean, QPR always have a chance, but, you know, balance probabilities, you go with Spurs.
Right, okay. Even though it'll mean so much to Harry, so much. Can you imagine?
But that's gambler's fallacy. You're sort of thinking that because it means more, that he will necessarily play better.
Does it mean more to his players? That's the thing. I don't think he's not got that across to them yet, has he?
Well... I'm not so sure. Not so sure about
is
that
this,
one.
Is this a Jumbo AC Jumbo gambling special?
I don't know. You're right. Maybe the heart swaying the head. You know, but maybe a 1-1 draw. I don't know. Probably they'll get whipped 4-0 or something. But what about then? What about Man United's clash with Liverpool? That's a big one.
You said before it could be a shootout between Suarez and Van Persie, and I think you might be right there. Van Persie has 20 in all competitions this season. Suarez has 19. Oh. Both defences have been pretty poor this season. United have conceded 28 goals. Liverpool have conceded 26. So it could be an exciting game.
Vidic is back, though, for United.
Well, the other thing Greg's doing is all making it kind of like, you know, a head-to-head thing. But actually, if you look at the last eight games at Old Trafford in the league, United have won seven of them. There was only the 4-1 in, what, 2008-9, I think, when Liverpool won.
That's the last time Liverpool won,
You know, so, you know, United, you know, I agree with Greg, they haven't looked perfect this season, but they keep finding a way to win. And even in the game in Anfield, where, you know, Shelby was sent off just for half-time, Gerrard scored. I think at the end of that game, Liverpool had more possession and more shots, despite having a man down. But United found a way to win, and they keep doing
but
that.
But United are a different team at Anfield compared to at Old Trafford as well. And I think, you know, United will take the initiative at Old Trafford. And Liverpool have looked completely different. When Liverpool haven't been getting pressed this season, they've looked in control, they've kept possession, they've played very well, you know, against Sunderland and against Fulham as well. But
big clubs.
Yeah. Any team that they've come up against who's pressed them, and they have gone to pieces a little bit. And I think at Old Trafford, United will do that, and that's where Liverpool might struggle. They've been marginally better since Lucas has come back into midfield.
Four wins in five now, I mean, it seems, you know, watching them from afar, that there is a bit of a shape coming together.
I don't know about that, because you say four wins in five, but in recent history, they've lost to Aston Villa 3-1, and they've at Stoke away they were particularly poor. They were very poor, in fact. So yeah, I mean, it's hard to know how Liverpool are going to play, but I'd like to think that they might be able to lift the game.
Interesting if he plays Sturridge and Suarez.
Yeah.
Well, that is interesting, because Suarez has finally begun to score goals the way he used to do back at Ajax, and playing as the lone, or as the false nine, or whatever you want to call him. And Sturridge, according to Rodgers, is very much going to be a central striker.
It's been sold as a centre forward, and that's what he seems to be saying. Although I thought it was interesting after the FA Cup tie, when Sturridge was asked afterwards, you know, have you been sold as a centre forward? Is that where you want to play after spending his whole career at Chelsea? Saying that's the only place he wanted to play. He was very diplomatic and said, "I'll play wherever the manager takes me," etc. So, you know, it remains to be seen whether they can work together, though.
The thing is, I still don't think he'll play just two forward. You know, he won't play two up front. I think he'll still play with three up front. Suarez will play occupied on the left or the right side. But even as a central striker, he moves across the line. He moves from left to right so much anyway. And I mean, a lot of his best work is coming in wide, cutting in on the byline. Suarez. And I think, you know, he might fancy his chances against Vidic, who will be a little bit rusty, and you know, as in turning, he might make him look like Clint Hill.
You would go with Sturridge and Suarez together, would you? Trying to exploit
I don't know if I will. I'm just saying I could see.
But you would, working. Would you? With United's problems at the back, Vidic maybe
perhaps,
a bit rusty.
Perhaps this weekend. Yeah, just give him a go, because Sturridge scored, and I think it's good to, you know, see his confidence will be high, even though it was against a non-league team.
Yeah.
Just on one other point on Liverpool, though, maybe this isn't the best thing for Rodgers. Just the waste of Nuri Sahin this season. He was a player who Rodgers fought really hard to get, to bring in, and Arsenal really wanted him. He was the Bundesliga player of the season 18 months ago, and he's just been wasted at Anfield. He came in and he played him out of position in a few games. He didn't play him in a holding midfield role, which he's like a metronomic Alonso type player. Didn't play him in that role. Then he disappeared for a bit, didn't seem to get much of a chance again, and returned and played in an advanced position in the Europa League, you know, again, not with the kind of players around him who he'd want. And then there's talk now that he's going to leave in January and perhaps go back to Dortmund. And that's Dortmund, who are the Bundesliga champions. And he's been, you know, overlooked for players such as Joe Allen and now recently Henderson. I mean, he's the only player possibly other than Gerrard who can play a ball over 30 yards accurately. And I think that is more telling about Rodgers. If Rodgers, who's supposedly got this passing football vision, can't get the best out of a player like Nuri Sahin, that is quite worrying for Liverpool fans, I suppose, to look at Rodgers and think, how has he wasted a player like that, more so than the results this season, which haven't been that great. And bringing in Allen and then going out and trying to sign Nuri Sahin and getting him as well, it's like, well, you know, perhaps he should have brought in one or the other, if that was the case.
Are Liverpool fans still behind Rodgers? They are, aren't they?
No, I think they are at the moment. I mean, it's still very the balance is still there. It could go either way, and particularly now with this run of games again, there's United and there's Arsenal away as well. those games, if Liverpool lose them, and you know, drop into the bottom half of the table again. If they win them, you know, again, it's not looking as bad. But I mean, this particular thing with Sahin is a bit worrying, because it's his vision that's being questioned there, rather than the results.
Well, 8th currently now, and 14 points, as we mentioned, off second place.
There's one other thing that's quite interesting. Yeah, right. Sorry, Liverpool and Man United fans kind of had this little agreement where they're going to try and fight these high ticket prices. And well, I'd like to talk more on that, but it's just something that one of the Liverpool fans said from the Spirit of Shankly group, who are quite vehement normally. He said, you know, we're a mid-table club and we're being asked to pay £62 to go away at Arsenal. It's just probably the first time ever you've seen like a statement from Liverpool fans accepting
the virtue of being a mid-table club.
Accepting, you know, the position and hoping to get a benefit from
it
financially.
Well, this has all come to a head because of the tickets. 900, I think, tickets
were sent back by
Man City.
Well, by Arsenal to Man City, because Man City fans didn't take them up at the Emirates.
Oh, right, okay.
But I mean, it's been an issue for a while, and I think this has just brought it to a head. I mean, and it's interesting that fan groups are now getting together, because for a long time this became another one of these tribal things where as soon as somebody said to Arsenal fans, "Oh, your ticket prices are too high," they said, "Oh, well, we're getting charged a lot of Spurs," which was, you know, didn't really help anyone and was slightly self-defeating. But there's no doubt that it's away fans that create the atmosphere. It's away fans that help make the Premier League the product it is, and they've been treated badly for an awful long time. You know, they've been charged high prices. You know, it's often quite difficult to follow your team away still. You know, it's not what it was 10, 15 years ago, but it's not the easiest.
Almost
experience.
Intentionally so. Some people are suggesting Stoke, for example, will pay £32, £30 less than what Man City fans are being charged. And FSF and Supporters Direct are in the process of arranging formal meetings between fan groups and the top flight. They want to see a £20 to £25 cap introduced for away games.
I'm not sure that's realistic. I mean, I don't think you get a £20 to £25 cap, but I think more uniformity. And I think it's one of those things where the Premier League won't take a lead, because they say, "Oh, we exist to serve our clubs," and the clubs will inevitably just charge what they can. So, you know, it's one of those issues where you want the Premier League to stand up and say, "Actually, this is so important to our product and the product we sell around the world for £5.5 billion that we need to make sure that these people can watch their team in an affordable way."
Because it is part of the spectacle, as you say, it is part of the atmosphere. It's one of the selling points of the Premier League. It's those full stadiums.
Yeah, when you watch the Premier League on telly as a fan abroad, if you're not aware of what the songs are that certain fans sing, you'd think, "Oh, it sounds great," but usually it's just the away fans you can hear singing at each home ground, you know, and that's what they probably think, "Wow, this..." You know,
they buy into the passion, the atmosphere, the culture.
And that is the away fans
who are
all generating that generally.
Right. Well, Norwich will be hosting Newcastle's away fans this weekend. Norwich lost their last 4, Newcastle their last 3. If they lose this, they could end up in the bottom 3, Newcastle. Debuchy to start, apparently, at the back, Newcastle. And there you go. Chris Hughton keen to get one over his old side, because we're talking about Harry Redknapp, but here's another manager. But we shouldn't factor that into our thing. Norwich, do you think, Sean? Will he get revenge?
Tough one to call.
Oh, he will. Go on.
But Newcastle really need to buy in this window, don't they? I mean, kind of there's talk of this move for Remy breaking down now, and they just desperately need a striker and a centre-half, it seems to me, you know, and if they don't get that, then you start to fear for them.
Reading will be facing West Brom. Not sure if there's been any more news on the idea of Danny Welbeck going to the Medeski Stadium. Has there been any more? No? There was this story yesterday. Sunderland, West Ham. Ooh. An unexpected relegation clash between Fulham and Wigan. Fulham, who are in 13th place, well, they're 6 points off the drop, to be fair. That's a bit of a distance.
Fulham are interesting, though, because before the game against West Brom, they had, I think I'm right in saying, they played 12 matches and had only won one of them. So, you know, a lot of people were looking at them thinking, well, they could be going down. Obviously, the win away at West Brom on New Year's Day, I think, which was a surprise. But Wigan is the kind of game that, you know, they do need to win. Wigan, I think, away from home, against sort of lower half clubs, aren't too bad if you look at this season and last season. But Craven Cottage, they've got a terrible record. They've lost 4 and drawn 1 of the last 5 there. So you would expect Fulham to, you know, to win that.
Well, it's a convincing argument that you make. What about then, to finish off, Arsenal's game with Man City? A Man City side that really... it's a huge game, this, for them, isn't it? Because the Champions League's gone. It's in the FA Cup. But the league, they're already 7 points behind United there. Lose this, they could be 10 points behind.
Well, again, I mean, you know, see last season, you write them off at your peril in a sense, but you're right. I mean, it feels like they're starting to lose touch.
You know? No Nasri, no Yaya Toure.
Nasri, no great loss going on this season's form.
Right. Really, no Aguero. Now, he might be.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, it's always big loss, yeah.
And of course, Theo Walcott, fired up by the advanced stage of the state of the contract.
The slowest moving contract talk since the last slow moving contract talks.
It's a tough one to call because this might be the worst Arsenal side that we've ever seen under Arsene Wenger.
Really?
But at the same time, City's away record against the traditional big four, the Chelsea, Manchester United and Arsenal over the last few years hasn't been very good. I mean, obviously they beat Man United last season, but they lost to Chelsea and Arsenal. The year before, they lost to Man United and Chelsea, only drew with Arsenal. So they haven't got a traditionally very good record. And also against Arsenal, they have a really poor record. Arsenal have won 3 and drawn 2 in the last 5.
Mm.
So
Arsenal as well. I mean, just in their recent form against other teams, they lost 2 games at the Emirates, draws against Southampton and Swansea.
Yeah, yeah. It's tough on, you know, if you look at purely the stats, you would think Arsenal. But the way both teams are playing, it's very tough.
Really? You look at the stats, you think Arsenal?
If you look at historical stats.
Right. I'm not sure about historical stats. All right. Okay.
It's one of the defining characteristics of the Premier League this year, though, isn't it? That these games are hard to call and everyone's losing a lot of games. So it's kind of it's far less easy to call than it might have been in previous years.
I just think City have still got so much strength around their squad, more so than Arsenal, and they can win the battle in midfield. I think Tevez is very important for City because whilst, you know, they have these ups and downs in the dressing room and these arguments and there's, you know, the mood in the dressing room is always questioned. I think Tevez is a player who he's been involved in that, but when he's out there on the pitch, he doesn't really seem affected by anything. He's such a difficult player to play against.
Mm. All right then, City to stay on track vis-a-vis their title rivalry with United.
Draw,
really? Great.
2-1 City.
Well, I look forward to that. Terrific. We will be looking back on it all in Monday's Football Weekly. Gregor, you'll be back with us on Monday, I believe.
Yeah, I'll be talking about a 2-2 draw.
Brilliant. All right, along with Amy Lawrence, who'll be delighting in Arsenal's magnificent performance against Man City, no doubt. In the meantime, many thanks to producer Ben, to Greg for now, Sean Ingle and Owen Gibson. And you too, listener, have a super weekend. Bye for now.
And don't forget to check out Jimbo's paper review. There's a brand new one up every Friday at guardian.co.uk/football. Worth.